Hello once again, and welcome back to Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Dr. Michael Daly joins us to respond to your questions and comments on emergency medicine. He comes to us from Albany Medical Center, where he is both an emergency medicine physician and director of pre-hospital emergency medicine. Dr. Daly earned his medical degree from Albert Einstein College, completed his in New York, of course, and completed his residency in emergency medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. He cares for patients of all ages who require immediate medical assistance and serves as medical director for the Regional Emergency Medical Organization. Dr. Daly, thank you so much for being here. We really, really appreciate it.
Alan, my pleasure. I'm glad to be here with you.
If you want to be part of today's conversation, give us a call at 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also check in with your questions and comments online at wamc.org/voxpop on Facebook at facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop or email voxpop at WAMC.org. So, Dr. Daly, I guess the first question is this. Since I have been in the emergency room a couple of times in my life, I'm always impressed by what you guys have to know. You have to know everything.
I like to think that we don't have to know everything, but we certainly have to know when we don't know enough and when to call for help.
But it is interesting. I mean, I keep thinking that the emergency room guys are guys who you'd want as your primary physicians because of their experience with a wide range of issues.
We have similar training to other people that take care of people across primary care. But in emergency medicine, our focus is usually on what to do in those cases of utmost emergencies, recognizing and then treating life-threatening injuries and illnesses.
So if one comes into the emergency room and they say, what's your complaint? And that person says, chest pain, they go to the head of the line, don't they?
They do.
Yeah. So have you ever seen somebody take advantage of that?
It's a pretty loaded question.
Okay. Let's move on. Let's go to Jerome in Schenectady. Okay. Jerome, 1-800-348-2551. Jerome in Schenectady, you're on.
Okay, hi. Yeah, I just had a simple question. I was shoving a snow in my...
Hey, Jerome, we're having trouble hearing you. Could you get closer to the microphone? Okay, go ahead.
Is that better?
Oh, yeah, it's much better. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I had a problem with, basically I was shoveling the snow up, and I felt like a slight twinge in my lower back, like maybe 3 days later. And I just wanted to know if there was anything I could do that was like, I didn't have to go to a doctor, basically, see if there was something I could do myself to, I guess, self-diagnose to see if there's something serious or like a slight nagging ache. It's not nothing like real painful. And I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
No. Stay on. We may have a question for you. Go ahead, doctor.
Oh, okay.
Jerome, I'm going to have a lot of questions for you before we can really start getting down to whether or not there are any potential hazards here. Some of them are going to be things that I'd just like you to think about and not to answer on the air, actually. The first thing that we think about with people with back pain is there any neurologic symptoms below the point where it hurts? So do you have any numbness or tingling down your legs? Have you lost function of your bowels or your bladder?
Nothing like that, no.
Good. I'm glad. That makes it more likely that it's less concerning. From there, we ask some other questions for all of our patients that we treat for back pain. In your case, I know you're a male by the sound of your voice, and that would change some of the questions a little bit. Then I would ask you whether or not you were over the age of 50, because that changes things as well.
Ah, okay. No, I'm right below the age of 50. I'm 47.
Was there anything he can do, Doc? In other words, how about a Motrin? Or one should not prescribe over the air. I know that.
No, I never want to prescribe over the air, Alan. But I think at the same time, recognizing the risks and benefits of some of these medications is important. Jerome is under the age of 50, which makes it less likely that it's concerning. I'm not going to spend time getting into whether or not he has any other risk factors like cancer or any recent invasive medical procedures that could leave him at risk for other bad things.
No, nothing like that.
Good. Well, from there, if he has normal kidney function, we would start with Motrin.
Hey, Jerome, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it. I'm sure a lot of people have made out better because of you. Thanks. Bye. Let's go to Diane in Salisbury. Okay, Diane, you're on with the doctor.
Hi. I was wondering, I don't have an answer, obviously. That's why I'm asking. But I know that you have to test for life. When somebody would go to the emergency room. But is it possible after they rule out anything life-threatening that they could have somebody, this happened to me, you know, like I had a muscular skeletal issue that was causing severe pain, chest pain, back pain, I mean, really severe for quite some time. And, well, it cost me a fortune until I got, you know, the right diagnosis.
So, Diane, is there, because there are other people behind you, is there a specific question?
I mean, is it possible to, you know, to have people that can diagnose things once they rule out life-threatening issues?
You mean like a psychiatrist, something like that?
Well, psychiatrists are, you know, a musculoskeletal person. I don't know, a chiropractor or something.
I think Diane, the important thing that you're really describing is the need for medical follow-up after you leave the emergency department. That certainly is one of our challenges that we face in the emergency department is we always want patients to be able to get adequate follow-up, preferably with their own physician or another primary care doctor. If they have an acute problem that requires intervention, we want to make sure that they follow up with the appropriate specialist. But in the emergency department, we're not set up for that type of continuing care because that's just not what we do.
But there are.
I guess I would get diagnostics. I'm just looking at the cost, you know, issues that we're facing, and so forth. And it just seems like once life-threatening things are ruled out, I guess I just wish that, you know, for follow-up care, things were suggested that at the lower end.
Oh, you mean like a chiropractor or something like that?
Well, I've seen it happen.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, Diane, I think the most important thing is that
and
we want to see...
Or a psychologist, you know, to see what purchase, you know.
Okay. Well, Diane, it's a great question, and we thank you. You got your answer, which is...
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
I'm just trying to brainstorm.
No?
You know, cost is such a big issue.
It is, and that, of course, has a lot to do with what this country is facing right now.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Diane, thank you.
You
so much. Bye. Okay, and we'll go to Ken in Delmar. Okay. Ken, you're up.
Hi. I had a question. I learned CPR many years ago, and I've heard recently that they changed the requirements for it. Is that true? And in addition to CPR, is there anything else we can do?
Ken, that's a great question and something that's pretty important for us to think about. On a daily basis, we work hard to make sure that we can take care of patients in cardiac arrest as efficiently as possible. And we've certainly seen a dramatic change in our results. And there are more people walking around today that suffered cardiac arrest than in the past. Probably the single most important thing that you can do as a quick and easy refresher from home would be to go to a website like handsonlycpr.org, where you can then get information from the Heart Association on how to take care of patients suffering from sudden cardiac arrest. But the single most important thing is for more people like you to be interested in helping others and then to learn as much as they can about that.
Could you use that website one more time, Doc?
I'm hoping I'm not messing it up, but I believe it's handsonlycpr.org.
Handsonlycpr.org.
And we'll confirm that right
now. We're having
staff
look into it as we speak. And if it's right, we'll tell you. Okay. And Ken from Del Mar, thanks for the great call. Very important. But, of course, there are still those things which give you a jolt. What are those called?
Those things are called defibrillators.
Right.
And one of the nice things about New York State is we have a requirement for defibrillators in our public buildings.
Right.
And those defibrillators in our public buildings and defibrillators in other places, like, for example, in the back of every New York State police car, there is a defibrillator. And those defibrillators have saved hundreds of New Yorkers at this point.
But doesn't somebody have to know how to work them?
Mm-hmm. And every single one of those New York State
troopers
knows how to use them.
But if it's in the downstairs in the Al Smith building, not necessarily.
Actually, what's remarkable, Alan, is one of the most efficient places, if there is such a thing, to suffer a sudden cardiac arrest is in an airport where there are lots of people rushing, lots of people under stress, and many people actually suffer cardiac arrests.
Right.
But strangers come to their aid using defibrillators from the walls, and they do a remarkably good job with just the training that the AED itself provides after you turn it on.
Thank you so much. Okay. Ken, thank you very much for calling. We're going to take a very short break, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York, offering minimally invasive spine surgery. Choose stmarys.com. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany. Japanese, Chinese, and sushi bar. Dinner entrees served with soup, salad, and shrimp appetizer. Dine-in, takeout, delivery, 518-432-0358. Anderson Center for Autism, Statsburg, New York. Announcing the opening of the new Anderson Center Clinic, providing clinical services throughout the WAMC listening area. AndersonCares.org. And Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BoydenandPerrin.com.
Well, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. That website on life-saving, you want to give it to us one more time? And we did check it.
It was handsonlycpr.org.
Handsonlycpr.org. You want a little refresher course, or even if you want to know something about it, would be a good place to go. All right. Again, that number is 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Eric in Albany. All right, Eric, you're on.
Hi, yes, sir. My question is, I am a 40-year-old male that was diagnosed with fibromyalgia about 3 years ago, and I've had a lot of flare-ups. Because we're going through pain control, titration of meds, trying to find what works best. What is the situation if I went to the ER where I couldn't get a pain control? How would that be perceived there, as not a lot of people are familiar with it?
Eric, that's a great question. It shows a lot of insight to the disease process. Fibromyalgia is a very difficult disease process for us to deal with in the emergency department because it doesn't demonstrate itself in any objective way except to the person who's having the pain. As a result, it's not something that's easy for us to treat in the emergency department. In most cases, we'll work with somebody the first or second time, but if someone ends up having lots of flares and ending up in the emergency department a lot of times, what will then occur is you'll show up on something called the iStop or the Registry of Pain Medicine Utilization.
Right. I'm already. That's my question because the specialist that I went to see, they've given me the hydrocodone and such, but I do not like to be on that kind of stuff, and I try to minimize as much as possible and do non-narcotic type items. But it just seems that as soon as they see that come up, or you come in with something from your physician that shows, you know, you've been on it and you haven't had control, they always think you're seeking, and that's what I'm always worried about, because there's been times where I can barely crawl out of bed, and my doctor's like, you know, go, you know, because it's the middle of the night, and get some relief, you know, or try and get relaxed, and I'm just so apprehensive about it.
That is difficult, and I think one of the things that I would ask you to do, because it sounds like you've got a really good relationship with a caring physician, would be to address that with them and see whether or not they have any suggestions on how to work with the emergency departments when you need to go in. One thing in the emergency department that we really always appreciate having is insight from a physician that knows their patient well. Because remember, we're getting to know you in those first few seconds as we walk in the door. So if we've already gotten a phone call from your physician, and certainly at Albany Medical Center, through the transfer center would be the way for, sorry, we changed the name to the Access Center, through the Albany Med Access Center, I would have your physician call us there so that a message can be left in the emergency department physician who's treating you can then get the insight from your physician to assist us.
So what's the Access Center?
The Access Center actually is a spectacular thing. It was developed a few years ago for all incoming patients that we treat because we have such a large catchment area. So it's for patients being transferred in from other institutions, but also for physicians who are sending their patients to the emergency department or to other areas of the hospital for care. It's nurses and some specialized trained personnel who will answer the phone, discuss the case with the transferring physician, and then make sure that we have enough information from those folks to
be
able to care
for them. Is that 724
or what?
24/7. 24/7, yes. Now, that's interesting. So if somebody, but clearly you might have, somebody might be addicted. Eric is certainly not one of them based on what he's telling us, but there might be somebody with an addiction problem who comes in. Is it your job to spot those people?
Someone told me a long, long time ago that they'd rather get caught, make the mistake of giving meds to an addict than not treat someone's pain efficiently. It's very difficult in the emergency department. As you know, as Eric and I were just talking about it, you've just got a few seconds to make a determination on whether or not you're going to care for somebody and how that care is going to be driven. The I-STOP legislation and now the need that we have for reviewing narcotic utilization is pretty important to make sure that we're caring for patients so efficiently.
Now, Dr. Daly, virtually every physician, if you're calling a physician, the first thing you hear is, if this is an emergency situation, hang up and call, 911 or whatever. It's 911? Yeah. That has got to add to your task, doesn't it?
It does. Mm-hmm. There are some dispensations that were built into I-STOP, which was actually very helpful. And some of the senators that worked on that legislation and assembly folk really built it to make it work reasonably well with us. At the same time, though, there is additional work. There are additional burdens, but it's what we do.
Yeah. Eric, anything else?
No, that's it. I just, like I said, I just wanted to have the knowledge, and so it's just have my primary care preempt my visit, and like he says, bring everything with me so, I'm being honest and truthful and upfront.
Eric, that's why we do the show. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
Yep, bye. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Max in Colerain. Max, you're on.
Hello?
Hey, Max.
Hey, it's Matt.
Oh, Mac, I'm so sorry, Mac. Could you speak more into the phone?
Yeah, 1 second. Any better?
Yeah.
I got a quick question. Me and my buddy, we lift weights to try and, stay in shape and healthy and all that. We're younger guys, almost 30 years old. And we were, I'm sure you guys are familiar with the deadlift.
Yes.
Well, it was getting kind of competitive, and it was getting pretty heavy, And he went to pick it up, and he got it up and everything. But he said he felt the pop in his neck. And after that, he felt kind of dizzy, and he had a headache whenever he got his heart rate got up again. And I was just what could that possibly be?
Mac, I think the important thing to recognize is, as an emergency physician, I'm always going to think the worst. And what you're describing, I'm thinking about several bad things. So what I'd really like to do is I'd like your friend to go to a doctor, either to his primary care doctor, or frankly, if this is something that just happened today, then he should go to an emergency department.
Yeah, well, I mean, it happened Friday, I believe, but he's fine whenever his blood pressure is low, he's not working out or anything, and he's kind of stubborn, so, hopefully I could tell him something that'll get him to go.
Well, you can tell him that I think it's a good idea for him to get this looked at.
Is there, what could possibly be wrong with him?
It could be anything from a pulled muscle to a stroke.
Well, I appreciate it. I'll definitely pass the news along to him.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Mac. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Gregory in Kingston. Okay, Gregory, you're on.
Good morning. Good afternoon. I feel I've been misdiagnosed by several doctors already. I'm doing as much research on my own. I've got lymph nodes that are 7 months already that are starting to metastasize, and I believe I've got what they call Bartonella, and these doctors don't seem to know anything about it, and I've been doing a lot of research, and this is what I'm sure I've got, and I'm wondering if you can shed any light on it, and if there's any references you can give me as to doctors in the Hudson Valley that might be able to help me.
Well, I'm actually an Albany physician, so I can't give you any advice about physicians down in the Hudson Valley. I can't
shed
tell.
Any light.
Sorry?
I'm sorry. Can you shed any light on this situation?
Well, there's a lot of different possibilities if you have increasing number of lymph nodes. The thing that I would, more than anything else, suggest you to do would be, if you're no longer happy working with your physician, to find another physician to work with.
I've done that already. They want to send me for radiation, you know, for CAT scans, for biopsies, whatever, and I don't feel they're necessary. I feel that this is what's going on, and I've just kind of lost trust in these doctors. They do everything in an allopathic manner, and I think that I need to go in a different manner.
Well, one of the things that's important is if you're seeing that the allopathic physicians that are caring for you aren't providing care in the way that you would prefer, then it might not be a bad idea for you to seek out osteopathic care as well. On the other hand, recognize that the disease processes that both arms of medicine think about and a lot of the ways that we train are very similar. At some point, you're going to have to decide exactly what you're going to trust from the physicians versus the research that you're able to do on your own. And hopefully you'll be able to find a physician that you can sit down with, have a conversation about the things that you're learning, as well as your concerns, and set yourself on a good course to find health for yourself.
Exactly. That's the way I feel, and that's why I'm looking for a doctor that will do that. But most doctors give me 3 minutes, it seems. And I'm afraid, and I'm afraid for everybody when Obamacare comes through that they're going to get 1 minute instead of 3 minutes with everybody, you know, with existing conditions coming in, you know?
Hey, Gregory, that's another show, but we thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Eric in Ellenville. Hey, Eric, go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing? Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
My question for the doctor is I work as a paramedic, and at the start of the new year, there's going to be the new collaborative protocols that are going to be coming in my area where I work in the Hudson Valley, which also I believe encompasses up in what we call the Remo area up in Albany and stuff. I was just wondering, question is twofold. One, your feeling on this, that, you know, because there's been some changes in that stuff. And the second thing is, as far as my experience with not so much in the larger medical centers, but even with some of the smaller rural hospitals and stuff like that, where the emergency room doctors, which we have to call to get orders for certain things that we cannot do on our own, so even with the older ones, they don't seem as familiar, and it almost seems like we're on the phone explaining sometimes to the doctor saying, no, we don't carry that medication. We can do this medication for this type of condition. Keeping the doctors up on what we're doing out in the field and how familiar they are with what we're doing out in the field.
Dr. Daly?
Eric, that's a great question and a problem that we face on a regular basis. One of the things that I think that the collaborative protocols will be extremely helpful at doing is bringing more of these physicians into the same area of knowledge. The more physicians we have that understand what paramedics are capable of, the more likely it is that you won't get questions about the care you're providing.
So what is this? What are these collaborative protocols, Doctor?
There are 18 regions in New York State. Mm-hmm. These are EMS regions.
Right.
Until probably about 4 years ago, there were 18 different sets of protocols. Over the course of the last few years, we've seen several sets of protocols merge. So right now, the Remo region actually was the first to do this. We sat down with our colleagues from the Mountain Lakes region to our north, as well as the Arams region to our west, joined together and came up with a single set of protocols. So physicians that practice in Albany or in Glens Falls or Plattsburgh would have the exact same body of knowledge to discuss with the paramedics that they're working with. And a paramedic who works in Glens Falls will be practicing under the same rules that they practice under in Albany.
But it would require that both the doctors and the paramedics knew what those protocols were, right?
Exactly.
And that's not the easiest thing in
the
world.
Actually, the paramedic side of it is, the paramedics are actually fantastic at learning their protocols. And one of the things that's really nice about having a collaborative set of protocols is that the paramedics can learn this as part of their training as well. The collaborative protocols as of January are going to be from Yonkers all the way to Quebec, and we'll go west to Utica and then down along the southern tier. So
pretty much the WAMC footprint.
The WAMC footprint, exactly.
Yeah. So, Eric, that's a good question. We thank you for making it, for asking it.
No problem. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you, Eric.
1-800-348-2551. Mike in Broomfield. Mike, you're on.
Good afternoon, Alan. How are you?
Well, I'm good. How are you, Mike?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Hi, Doc.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. Okay, I have von Hippel-Lindau syndrome. And I was telling your caller, I've seen these medical ID tags that have a thumb drive in them. And I'm wondering, is that kind of a universal thing? Do I just fill out a form on my computer with a thumb drive in it and then have the doctors add their stuff? And is this kind of universally going to be accepted?
Okay, before you answer, Mike, if you can, first question is, what's the disease?
Von Hippel-Lindau syndrome.
Okay, and thank you for that. And then, doctor, you were going to check in on the thumb drive.
The thumb drive is one sort of Band-Aid towards an answer that hopefully we'll get shortly. There's something called the Regional Health Information Exchanges, or the, I think, the Regional Health Information Organization, the RIOs. Regionally, we have one called HICSNE, or Health Information Exchange of New York. These are extremely helpful at allowing physicians to see both emergency department records as well as records from care at other hospitals and in primary care offices.
Interesting.
This will hopefully continue to grow. Obviously, there are privacy concerns that people have that are being dealt with by computer information technology experts. But from my perspective in an emergency department, what it allows me to do is to see what's happening in terms of somebody's health care and be able to treat you from your records.
Right. But what I'm getting at is I don't live in the Albany, the WAMC listening. Well, I do it because I'm out here in Massachusetts. But, my thing is I travel a lot. And would it be helpful if I went into your ER room, where I'm also a diabetic and I'm in a diabetic low sugar situation, and you see this and plug it in? Can you do that?
If I see one, I'll give it a shot. Basically, what we're going to do in the emergency department is do everything we possibly can to figure out what's going on with you and understand as much as we can, as quickly as we can, about your past medical conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have that, and we know that it's there, because remember, some of these may be so nicely put together that it may look more like a piece of jewelry than a medical alert. If we find it, we'll use it for everything we possibly can to take care of you as well as we can.
Fair enough. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Have a good afternoon.
Okay. And let's see. We'll go to Martha in Gansford, 1-800-348-2551. Don't be shy. You've got a question, ask it. Martha, you're on.
Hi. I have a friend who's had swollen lymph nodes for about a year on her back and her neck. And I guess they've taken some blood tests and maybe a quick biopsy, and now they want to surgically remove a lymph node and examine it to see what could be wrong. Her husband does not think that she should have this done, and I was wondering, what could the swollen lymph nodes be indicating?
Oh, Martha, the differential diagnosis or total number of different things that some swollen lymph nodes could be is huge. If her physicians at this point are interested in excising a lymph node in order to better delineate what's going on, that's probably the best course to follow.
I guess they can't determine what is causing it. But what are some of the dangerous things that it might be that haven't shown up readily?
Well, remember, when you do something like a needle biopsy, you're getting a very small core of the lymph node itself. So there may not be enough tissue that's actually been excised in order to be able to make a diagnosis. So that's why they want to look at a larger sample of that lymph node and be able to get a better understanding of what's actually going on in there.
Right. And what would this indicate? I mean, just the swollen lymph nodes. I mean, what would could she be looking at?
Well, swollen lymph nodes indicate that there's some type of reactivity going on. Whether that reactivity is because of an infection somewhere that hasn't yet been delineated or something as bad as cancer, I can't tell you over the radio.
Oh, I have one question. Would the C-reactive protein test indicate that there was something that she should worry about?
A C-reactive protein test, like some of the other tests that we have out there, you may have heard of the erythrocyte sedimentation rate, or the ESR. Both are very nonspecific tests. They just say something's going on. So
yeah.
It doesn't give you any more information than by seeing a little bit of smoke in the air and knowing that somewhere there's been a fire.
Right. But then if nothing showed up on the C-reactive protein test, there's probably nothing to worry about?
I wouldn't in any way, shape, or form interpret what I just said as that.
Right.
Hey, Martha, got to go. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back. We're going to take a very, very, very short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Bassett Healthcare Network, bringing heart care to the people of Herkimer, Cobleskill, Cooperstown, Oneonta, and surrounding areas. Bassett.org. Woodstock School of Art, offering classes and workshops in drawing, painting, printmaking, sculpture, and more for all levels. Tuition assistance available. WoodstockSchoolOfArt.org. Middletown Medical, now offering evening walk-in urgent care for children every weeknight until 9, plus evening sports physicals, 845-342-4774. And Four Seasons Natural Food Store and Cafe, Saratoga Springs, New York. Locally owned and operated since 1988. Open 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. 7 days a week. FourSeasonsNaturalFoods.com.
Okay, so we are back. Let's go to Marie in Schenectady. Okay, Marie, your turn.
Hi, both doctors today. Got a question to ask about cellulitis. If there's any more insight as to what causes it, my husband was an inpatient at Ellis, and the primary care doctor, one of Alan's frequent guests of that group, prescribed a sulfa. He had been on an antibiotic. But anyway, he's better, rid of the cellulitis. How common is it, and is there any more information you can give me? What causes it, please?
Cellulitis is a skin infection, Marie. And unfortunately, we don't always know exactly what it is. It's very difficult to track down and figure out the exact bugs. So when we do treat it, we treat with relatively broad-spectrum drugs to hit the most likely targets. Because it's just an infection that is disseminated within the layers of the skin rather than being deeper and invasive. So it's actually a difficult process to take care of.
So what does it look like? What does cellulitis look like?
Thank you very much.
Stay there, Marie. Yeah.
No, it's bright red, hot, angry, painful skin.
Awful. Awful looking. And I live in Schenectady. Talking to some very bright pharmacy students, says Marie, up at Memorial Hospital, these are pharmaceuticals with the 6 years of training. Very, very common. I didn't know how common it was.
Yeah. Marie, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's everybody keep your questions as focused as you can. Let's go to Catherine in Saratoga. Okay, Catherine, you're on.
Yes, I'm wondering about, I live in Saratoga, and we have a new urgent care center there in Malta, and this relationship with Saratoga Hospital in Albany Med, and I was wondering, I'm sure the doctor is very active with that, and I'd like to know what his take is on it.
I not only am active, I also practice there.
Ah, good, okay.
Oh, so, they send you to both emergency rooms?
Yeah. Right, exactly. So there is always a faculty physician from Albany Medical Center practicing at the urgent care in Malta. And it truly is a collaborative relationship between Saratoga and Albany Med. It's an exciting place.
So is every doc at Albany Medical Center, you say a faculty position, is everybody also a faculty member? Or do you have people who work there at Albany Med who are not faculty members?
Everybody who works in the emergency department at Albany Med is on faculty at the medical college.
Interesting. And do you teach?
We do.
When people come in, you train them how to be emergency physicians, right?
Exactly. We're treating residents on a regular basis. We teach medical students the ins and outs of the emergency department. And then some of us go out and do additional teaching in the community as well.
Wow. Interesting. Okay, Marie, Catherine, anything else?
Yeah, I was wondering, too, a lot of people that are calling are talking about things related to primary care. And they're like talking to an emergency room physician about that. How do you think Obamacare is going to impact the amount of people that show up in your emergency room with primary care issues? Do you think it's going to improve for you folks?
I got to tell you, Catherine, I'm really just not sure. Right now, we certainly see a lot of people with what I would consider would be primary care-related issues, but some of them are there, although they have primary care physicians, because they can't get in to see their primary care doctor. Or because that problem is significant enough to them and it's off hours and your primary care doctor isn't there at 2 o'clock in the morning. An emergency physician is always working 24/7. We've always got faculty physicians ready to take care of you. So
what do your hours look like? I mean, how do you do it?
Well, the important thing with anybody that works shift work is just to remember to sleep after the shift.
Uh-huh.
So
do you always know what shift you're going to be on?
Yes. We're scheduled months in advance so we can plan our lives around those shifts.
And you have issues with sleep cycles?
Well, sleep cycles are difficult.
Yeah,
sleep
are
cycles
they?
Are difficult, but it's something at this point where it's an expectation. So is family life.
Is there ever a time when things are so slow that you get to close your eyes?
Not at Albany Med.
Not at Albany Med. Catherine, thank you very much for the great call. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Bye.
And we'll go to John in Albany. Okay, John, you're on. Hey, John.
Yes,
you're
hello?
Yeah.
Yes, I was wondering, currently I suffer from glaucoma, and I was wondering, is there anything that I could possibly do to try to eliminate that or reduce symptoms?
John, the single most important thing you can do if you have been diagnosed with glaucoma already is to work extremely closely with the ophthalmologist who's caring for you, making sure to take all of the medications and all those drops exactly as they are prescribed and to follow any of the warning signs that your doctor's given you for seeking emergency care on top of that.
Now, we've done a whole program on glaucoma here, but glaucoma is what, basically pressure in the eye?
Yeah, it's pressure in the eye, and it can be a real problem for people acutely as well. But someone like John, who's already got the diagnosed disease, most important thing he can do is follow directions from those physicians as exactly as he possibly can to make sure that there isn't any ongoing damage to the eye.
So when does he come into the emergency room?
His doctor should give him very specific or discreet directions on when to come to the emergency department. But basically, decreased vision or increased pain are going to be two of the most important things that he's going to follow.
It's interesting. A couple of times you've corrected me, and I certainly accept that. Where I said the emergency room, which is what everybody says, and you've said the emergency department. Is this a relatively new thing, or is this the way it's always been?
That's funny, Alan. I didn't even realize that I was doing it. But the emergency department is a sort of a larger way of looking at the same area.
Right.
We're not just one room anymore.
Sure.
We actually are a focused department within
sure.
the hospital.
I got that. Thanks a lot. Hey, John, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Jackson in Great Barrington. Okay, Jackson.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well.
So I'm calling because I have a small bump on my head that's been growing very slowly for the past 2 or so years, and I'm curious as to what this bump is. It seems to be relatively harmless, and I've gotten it checked out before, and it seems to be harmless, and I'm wondering if you know what that is.
Okay, go ahead, Doc.
Well, Jackson, I think the most important thing here is you've had something growing on your head for a couple of years. If the physicians that you've gone to have said it was harmless, I would go back to them and say, hey, how has this changed since the last time you took care of me? Was it a couple of millimeters last time and now it's a centimeter? What does it look like and how has it changed? Because maintaining continuity with a physician on something like a growing lump or bump is going to be important because they'll be able to really recognize interval change that'll help them with diagnosis.
Okay, thank you.
Wait, have they done any kind of biopsy on this thing?
I think it might be something called a dermoid cyst, which is based on some research that I did on my own. And my doctor also said that this is actually a common occurrence among patients and that it's like it's not a rare thing to just have a random bump on your head.
Okay. Hey, Jackson, thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye.
Good day.
Let's go to D in Glenmont, 1-800-348-2551. We've got enough time for a couple more phone calls, and we'd like you to be one of them. Go ahead, D.
Hi, Alan. Hi, doctor. Quick question. Why don't physicians tell people who smoke cigars and pipes to quit smoking as opposed to cigarettes?
Why don't people quit smoking?
I
think, Dee, that was a little flippant on my part, and I apologize. But really,
okay.
Across the board, we as a society have come to recognize the hazards that come from tobacco use, whether
right.
it's cigarette use, cigars, pipes, dip, or chewing tobacco.
Okay.
At the same time, in different situations, we're going to interpret the information that we're given differently. And primary care physicians in particular are going to be encouraging their patients who they find out are using these products to quit. In the emergency department, if we're given an opportunity to, we'll encourage people to quit as well, and we'll certainly point people towards resources like the New York Smokers Quit Line and others to try to get people to stop using these products and avoid long-term health risks.
Yeah, my dad is 80 years old, and none of his specialists or primary care ever tell him to stop smoking his pipes and cigars.
Interesting.
We question them about it, but, you know, the old myth was that cigar smoking and pipe smoking were not as bad as cigarettes, and I've heard that it's 3 times worse.
Well, I'm not sure we can actually quantify it in terms of times worse. It's different worse.
Okay.
Cigars and pipes seem to do more long-term hazard to the inside of the mouth than cigarette smoke.
That's how Freud died.
Mm-hmm. Right. And cigarette smoke is probably worse in the lungs. So it's a question of which is badderer, I think.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks,
okay, thank you, and good luck with your father.
Yeah.
Thanks.
What did I do here? Yeah, okay. Mark in Albany, 1-800-348-2551. You still got time. Don't be, punching yourself in the head all for the rest of the afternoon saying, I could have had a V8. You could have called. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, how you doing? Am I on?
You're on, but just barely. Get close to the microphone.
Okay. Hey, I got this thing that I've had for a couple years where every couple months this top layer of the skin on my hand peels off. It's painless. I just peel it off a centimeter at a time. And then I get to the next layer of skin and it goes away. And then another couple months it comes off again. Has this, either of you guys seen that?
It's interesting, Mark. Actually, I haven't. I would recommend that at some point you go to a primary care physician, talk to them about it. Certainly a dermatologist would be another place to go.
Sure.
I would certainly talk to your primary care doctor about it. It's interesting. The fact that it's painless is helpful and probably part of why you're calling me instead of having gone to a physician earlier. But I would definitely say get to a physician at some point and ask them their thoughts.
Yeah, I went to a dermatologist, and the guy was like, and he never got back to me. He never saw it, so that's weird, huh?
Interesting. Certainly, if you got into a dermatologist, that's fantastic and the most important thing in terms of getting a definitive answer.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Hey, Mark.
I just got a push. All right, thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
All right, take care, Mark.
1-800-348-2551. Once very early, when I went to the emergency room in Great Barrington, which is, by the way, a great emergency room at Fairview, I got a call and said, hey, if you have records of your heart stuff that have been taken, it would be good to get it to us so we can always have a comparative readout. Mm-hmm. Is that something you could talk about for a minute?
Yeah, actually, that goes back to, and I can't remember, unfortunately, the name of the caller, but the caller that was talking about having the little thumb drive attached to a med alert bracelet.
Sure.
The more of your records you have for us to be able to take care of you, the better. And sometimes the most important thing that we can look at if somebody comes in with chest pain would be an old EKG.
And why is that? Because you can see if there's a change.
Exactly. As we were saying earlier, interval change. Is there anything that's new?
Okay, great. Let's go to Susan in Ballston Lake. Okay, Susan. Now, you people, I'm mad at you because every phone is ringing now. Okay, go ahead, Susan. We'll try to get through all of this.
Oh, hi, Doctor.
Hi, Susan.
I'm wondering if you know anything about Hollenhorst plaque in the eye. My eye doctor seemed quite concerned that I have that. And when I went to my primary care doctor, his reaction was, well, I don't know what that is. And he did, my eye doctor wanted me to have a carotid ultrasound. So my primary care doctor did prescribe that, and I did have that done. But I don't have the results yet. But I'm just wondering about my risk for future ischemic events with this. And I'm a little concerned because my doctor just kind of blew it off, whereas my eye doctor seemed very concerned.
Well, Susan, it sounds as though your doctor followed the recommendations of the eye doctor, which is one of the most important things that can happen in that situation. This falls into that category where I was earlier mentioning that in the emergency department, if we don't know what to do, we call the people that do. And Hollenhorst plaque isn't something that I'm familiar with, but I would certainly call and speak to my ophthalmologists about it to get more information if you were to come into the department.
Susan, okay. Thank you. Thank you, Susan. Okay, let's go to Chris in Leverett. Okay, Chris, you're on.
Oh, hi. I'm calling because I wonder, my question is, when do you go to an emergency room and when do you go to your regular doctor? This past summer, I was bitten by a dog, and I went to my regular doctor. I didn't actually see the doctor. I saw a nurse practitioner and a nurse, and then it got worse and worse, so I finally went to the emergency room, and my feeling was that the people at the emergency room knew much more about dog bites than the primary care doctor. And I wonder if there's occasions like that, like breaking your leg or something, when you should probably just go to the emergency room and not to your primary care doctor.
Chris, I think you're absolutely right. There are a number of situations where you should go directly to the emergency department. And the acuity of those situations is going to really be the most important thing. If you're having shortness of breath, if you're having chest pain, if you suddenly notice that you're weak on one side of your body, those are times to call 911 and come to the emergency department. I think you were a little almost joking as you said, if you break your leg, you come to the emergency department. You're absolutely right. That would be another indication.
Right.
And dog bites, depending on how serious they are, may be things that are best treated in an urgent care or an emergency department.
Right.
But primary care physicians and urgent cares may also be excellent places to take care of them. The thing to recognize is that anytime there's an animal bite, there's going to be a significant amount of bacteria from the mouth of that animal that's going to be left under your skin. And in those situations, they can get worse.
Right.
And it sounds as though you did the right thing, which was it was getting worse, so you sought additional care rather than continuing.
Yeah.
Okay, well done.
Very quickly, thank you very much. We're not going to be able to take any more calls because we're basically out of time, so I want to ask you something now that you've brought it up. Doctor, will you tell us about the difference between going to an emergency room and urgent care?
We actually in the area have different levels of urgent care now, which make it very interesting and sometimes difficult to make decisions about. There are urgent cares where they are available 12 hours of the day. There are also several urgent cares that are now available 24 hours of the day. Those are the emergent care ones that we were talking about in southern Saratoga. And then there's the emergency department.
But, of course, one of the difficulties about going to an emergency room is that they're expensive.
They are. They're very expensive.
Urgent care, less expensive?
Urgent cares are less expensive
because,
to no small extent, they maintain a less amount of technology.
Gotcha. Well, we are out of time. I want to thank everybody who called in, and we had a lot of people. By the time we were done, all five phones were ringing. We are just about out of time. I want to thank everyone who called. Thank you, Dr. Michael Daly, for joining us today. This is really great to have you here. You're terrific.
It was my pleasure. Thank you,
thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Beloy. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell. Tom Jobe handled our social media. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.